the metaphor that we used at the time was, you're taking the most powerful, sophisticated form of advertising we have ever conceived of, and then you're asking buyers to dig through the trash to find gems. This does not make any sense at all.
And he said, early to bed, early to rise. He said, early to bed, early to rise. Early to bed, early to rise. Eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
So this week, I'm happy to welcome Andrew Casale to the program. Unlike most of our guests, maybe all of them so far, actually, Andrew has been at the same company pretty much for the past two decades. It's a company he started back at the beginning of the millennium when he was just a teenager. Andrew's been president and CEO at Index Exchange since 2015. Before that, he was VP of strategy at Casale Media, the previous incarnation of Index, and he's based in Toronto, Canada.
Par PT Barnum, above all else, yeah, Barnum. Everybody's got to be Par PT Barnum, because it's not.
So I like to start with a random personal question. Do you have any pets and what are their names?
Yes, I do. Proud to say I am the loving father of two cats, Gus and Sade.
So as a kid in Canada, and I'm assuming you grew up in Canada and back in the 90s, was there technology in the house or was it in your family?
Absolutely. My father's an electrical engineer by schooling, and just an incredible computer entrepreneur. You know, early computing technology, early internet. I was the kid that would make a GeoCities website. Yeah. You know, Alta Vista all the way.
Oh yeah. Were you excited about Mosaic when it came out?
Netscape was the earliest browser in my memory.
I think you said that you sort of fell into building websites. How did that happen?
It's funny, the story of ad tech for me and for us and the story of our founding, it was almost like ad tech found us. It wasn't the other way around. One thing that I was pretty excited by were early day hit counters. Where, you know, for the longest time I would make something, put it up there, and if the hit counter went up, it was me. And I just fell into this world of building site after site and finding a way to create a value prop where people would come back. I got to know how, you know, early web traffic worked with major portals. Yahoo was such a big deal. You know, back in the day, the name of a website was a big deal. Your letter was ABC or it started with a number, you'd be ranked higher. And also fell into the world of advertising sometime thereafter once I'd built websites that were building audiences.
Well, what were some of the sites that you built?
My last foray was reality television. I loved it. It was early at the time, you know, Survivor season one. Yeah. And I was building a very humble media empire, all centered on reality television. And, you know, found that it was an incredible opportunity to be first. You know, I was always big on breaking a story or breaking news. Found myself in a position where, you know, people were knocking on the door and wanted access to those audiences. And so early ad tech was also something that I was an early user of. And the names back then are different too. You know, companies like Flycast or FastClick or even prior to ad.com, they were TechnoSurf. So I found myself being a very early user of ad tech a very long time ago.
TechnoSurf. Yeah. So you were building these sites. Were they for clients or were they your own ideas?
It was just me. Yeah, it's all passion, really. But the last series in reality television, it actually kind of became, for me at the time, a pretty big deal. I got to know the editors at major portals like Yahoo, and they were always keen on having access to content first. And so when I'd have a piece that was breaking, I'd fire an email out to the editor at Yahoo, and then I'd be on the homepage of the entertainment section and have all kinds of traffic coming through. So it was pretty wild. It was a very, very different world back then. I was more of an independent, very, very small and humble publisher. I've pretty much used and worked with all of the old original guard. Even DoubleClick, they were the illustrious ad network in the late 90s that no one could ever get into before they became an ad server exclusively. And honestly, that's the origin story of our company as well. Being a customer of some of those emerging platforms, kind of unsatisfied. There was like the world of today's ad tech is nothing like the world back then. You were a ticket, a number, and you were kind of paid what you were paid. And I also found myself in a community of independent publishers who all kind of had the same gripes and all the same concerns, and really spotted an opportunity to, instead of, you know, continuing on a path to be some kind of a media company publisher, which may have been fun, to instead try to be a part of reimagining early platforms in ad tech with a publisher-minded view instead of a marketer or buy-side exclusive view. And that's really how we got our start.
Is it so in 2000, round around then, I guess your company started, what was your dad's involvement? Because you were, how old were you? 15?
Yeah, there was no formal business plan or grand plan in our early days. I think he was supporting me in me exploring, you know, the business world. And he was, you know, an incredible supporter. But somewhere along the way, it went from a dream or, if nothing else, a fun venture slash project into a real business. You know, in between school and doing this part time, I remember
leaving high school. Andrew.
Yes, high school, Andrew. I had a cell phone, not like a, you know, a fancy phone that would, yeah, flip phone that I'd have my servers send text messages to if they were ever up or down. And so I'd be in school, going through school, and I'd get alerts on my cell phone saying, you know, the server's down. You should do something about that. But somewhere along the way, it became more real where the my early ventures, my early publishing ventures had actually generated a fairly significant amount of capital that formed the seed for what was ultimately going to become Casale Media. Believe it or not, it was in the realm of the millions of dollars that my websites had generated by the time that it was like, you know what, let's actually try to do something here. And
did this help your standing in the high school set? Were you cooler than other people, or did it not matter?
I think I was probably like the I certainly had, you know, friends and all that, but I think I was largely perceived to be strange because I was far more fixated in, you know, cell phone, or when we'd, you know, be in a computer class or whatever, I'd find a way into my server terminals than doing classwork and that sort of thing. So I was a bit of an odd duck, no doubt. So
you're an entrepreneur from the beginning, clearly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We at some point we made the decision to take it seriously and put pen to paper. You know, created two primary documents. One was a spec on what it would take to create a platform, effectively at the time an ad network / ad server, and we modularized it and turned it into requirements docs that ultimately led to us being able to flesh out roles and recs and build an early engineering group to create the dream.
So the 2000-2001, that was a big kind of meltdown. Quite dramatic. I mean, some of the stories I've heard about 24/7 and even DoubleClick had hard times. Did that have any impact? Because that's right when you were starting. Did you have any thoughts about whether this was a viable idea?
In hindsight, it almost feels like creating an ad tech company when we did was quite possibly the worst time we could, but I think turned out to be a great time.
In retrospect,
In retrospect. Yes. Yeah. If the web as we know it was going to end after the dot-com bust, then that dream probably would have died. But, you know, all I can recall was finding that talent and recruiting was a little easier than anticipated.
So your company that you started right in the beginning, what was it called originally? Was it Casale Media?
So the company started as Casale Media. At the time, just about everybody in ad tech was an ad network. We were too.
Yeah.
Always really more interested and in focused on the platform, the marketplace, the problems of scale, and a desire to create efficiency. And at the time, it was really just me always having a publisher hat on, saying it is incredibly hard to be a publisher and make the economics work. You can't just build a publisher-oriented platform, put it on the internet, and press the go button. You know, if you build it, they won't come. You have to also find the marketers. You know, 10 years later in the programmatic era of ad tech, that problem also somewhat solved itself with the hailing of the split between the exchange and the DSP. But at the time, it didn't exist.
What technology did you build? Did you build an ad server?
The original spec called for a very, primitive ad server. The bigger part of the focus was a platform that would allow publishers to control and see everything. So one of the gripes with early ad tech was, as a publisher, you'd be given ad tags, you'd throw them on your site, and you'd log in and have very, very poor insight into what was going on, a lack of control. And you'd kind of just be given a check. And so, you know, maybe you made $2,000 or $20,000. You wouldn't really know why. You weren't really in control of that process. And so most of the focus in the build was build a bare bones ad server that can support very basic marketer needs, and then give the publishers a lot of transparency and control, reporting, ad controls, that sort of thing.
So your competitors then at the time would have been like DoubleClick and Ad.com and 24/7? Potentially?
Yeah, the early day competitors. By that point, DoubleClick was becoming more of just an ad server.
Yeah.
So the early day competitors would have been FastClick, ValueClick, Ad.com, Tribal Fusion. This was in the pre-addressable data-driven ad tech market. So when you were targeting ads, you were pretty much saying, you know, this is an entertainment site, this is a sports site, this is a news site, and that was categorization only. Mm-hmm. There was no notion of cookies or data-driven, audience-driven marketing. That came maybe about 5 years later.
What was your differentiator then as a network? Did you have a pitch as to how you were better and different?
Yeah. Ironically, it doesn't sound dissimilar to Index today, but it was obviously very different back then, and we probably framed it differently. But the pitch was, as a publisher, full empowerment. So, you know, rather than us cutting a check and controlling what's going on your website, we had a phrase, ads are content too, and you should be in control of that. So just something as simple as full transparency, line by line level transparency into every campaign running, the ability for publishers to preview, block, and control. That was novel at the time. That was a big one. And then full transparency into our business model. The ad network over that decade got really marred because of opacity of business model, where, you know, some bigs were in the range of 50%. We never played that game. We were never in that space, but unfortunately the category got absolutely destroyed with that perception. I got to know quite a few independent publishers, and a lot of them took a bet on us. You know, back then you could add another button to a website, and you know, even if it wasn't generating a ton of income at the beginning, I think enough of them gave us a shot that we were able to build a market out of it. But even as we got to the programmatic story, the why Index and why did we make the pivot that we did, you know, it came as much from guidance from our publishers as it did from agencies saying, pick a side. The network is not going to have longevity. Either stay sell side, go buy side, but you can't pick both.
What was your office like? You're based in Toronto. What was your culture and sort of the feel of your off in the early years?
We started like
assuming you didn't stay in your kitchen table the whole time.
My father had another business, so he was kind enough to give us basically a room in his office building. But we started it's sort of like a valley-ish vibe, but it was a long room. You know, when we started hiring engineers, our first six hires at the company were engineers. And so you kind of can imagine a row of six desks and then me. And that was it. And we were focused at the beginning to just build the preliminary platform that would allow us to generate an ad tag to give to a publisher, allow somebody on the buy side to log in to book a campaign. Very, very humble. We were basically in a room in an office building that was focused on a totally different business.
So you were the Toronto Silicon Valley.
It's the closest thing to our garage story as we can claim.
So you mentioned this, and in 2010, you know, more or less, the industry began to change and became programmatic. And there was a splitting, the demand side, the supply side, and exchanges in the middle. And some ad networks had to change, you know, because programmatic appeared. And some of them went more to the demand side, building DSPs. Some of them did both. And then some focused on publishers. How did you negotiate that time and make a decision on where to focus?
It's a great question. You know, the early signal for change was coming around the era of every holding company standing up a trading desk. Yeah. You had VivaKey, Audience On Demand, Zaxis. I think I got a couple of them.
Amnet.
That was it. Yeah, Amnet. An obvious signal that change was upon us. Had a ton of conversations, spoke to our best publishers, spoke to a bunch of agencies, and really just tried to reimagine our place in this future that was emerging. What became abundantly clear is, you know, the ad network, you know, if you want to kind of look at the bad that came out of it, playing two sides of the transaction, you know, being a representative of the publisher's interest and being a representative of the marketer's interest invariably required at times to make a single decision, and often created enough opacity to bury interesting fees and business models. And so this pivot was going to effectively rip that paradigm in half. It made a lot of sense to us. And you know, there was a frustration we had even competing with ad networks in that decade where we thought we were different. We thought we were, you know, very transparent in our approach, but the category was so twisted and impossible to differentiate through that none of that ever really got far into the minds of people's own assessments. I do remember one polarizing email, which was, I think it was from Kurt Unkle at VivaKey, Audience On Demand. I think he basically said, you know, my advice, stop calling on us. If you want to continue to service the buy side, call the guys at Invite Media. And this was, I think, before they were acquired by Google. Took a call with them, very generous call. I think at the beginning of the call, they were confused on why we were calling them, because I think their view was, we're here to effectively replace you. Why would you call us? And, you know, what I recognized was our value and our interest has always and will always be the sell side. We love publishers. We know them really well. We've always served their interests. I did not see the path to being a DSP desirable one for our ethos. I tried to, you know, conceive of an opportunity to work with this new guard that was going to increasingly be diverting agency budgets, which traditionally were going to ad nets, into these early emerging DSPs. And they very generously, you know, leaned into the prospect and gave us a spec, which was not OpenRTB. It was effectively the precursor to what we now call OpenRTB. But that became about a year-long project at Index to, at the beginning, kind of reconceive the platform in a programmatic world, but eventually became the foundations of the exchange.
The concept of an SSP hasn't come up before in our show. So if you don't mind, could you, for some of our listeners, could you just explain what an SSP does, the thing that you built?
Absolutely. If you kind of like look at you know, any form of media transaction today, you know, you go to a website, pop up the Washington Post, maybe you see a banner ad, you open a video player, and before your content, you see a pre-roll or a mid-roll in between. You open up Candy Crush, and maybe before your next game, you see a quick interstitial. Those are all, you know, advertising opportunities that we call bid requests. There are two parties typically in transactions that ultimately lead to the display of any of that ad content. One party represents the publisher's interest, and one party represents the marketer's interest. And so we sit on the sell side. We work on behalf of the publisher. That's typically referred to as either an SSP, a supply side platform, or an ad exchange. Our job is to make each one of those opportunities available at scale to every buyer imaginable and all the platforms that represent their interests, and ultimately help our publishers maximize their yield, connect into DSPs, you know, a trade desk, MediaMath, and the like, who ultimately are representing the marketer's interests and placing the bid with the associated media budget.
So your competitors would be companies like Rubicon at the time, and PubMatic, yep, and OpenX, right? Other SSPs. I would assume.
Yeah, that, the original SSP guard, absolutely. Rather than having the invite media conversation where we were finding a way to work with early DSPs at the time, the competitors to what we were becoming were the PubMatics and Rubicons of the world, for sure.
So you built this, obviously you had to build some new tech. When did it go live? What was your first sort of DSP integration, your first campaign?
I'll always remember this. It was in the summer of 2011. And the first bid that we processed actually happened in an event that we were at. We were sitting on a patio, believe it or not, in the mountains. We were at an event in Banff, in beautiful Banff, Alberta.
It's lovely.
And the first bid happened on a laptop on that patio. And it was a bid request that we had submitted to the DSP Adnetic. They became Digilent. They were supported by Havas. That was DSP number one for early index and bid number one.
What was the brand?
It was. I think it was Nissan. It was definitely an automotive, but I think it was Nissan.
Now, what the product was? It called Index Exchange, or was there a different name?
When we were kind of starting this pivot, the step one was make the decision that we were going to consciously move the company out of the ad network space and into the exchange space. Part number two was we need to connect 20 of these pipes before we're going to have enough liquidity to do it. Part number three was we have to wind down our media business as we wind up our programmatic business and really replace dollar for dollar. During that transition, we called the predecessor to Index, I believe it was Casali X. We just put an X at the end of it. Nice. But once we had replaced every media dollar with a programmatic dollar and we effectively were taking no IOs and we were out of the media business, we renamed the company to Index Exchange to signify that our pivot was complete.
Was it difficult to wind down the media business?
Probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do, in the sense that we were building our future and gracefully winding down our past. And we also had to keep the lights on. But through sheer will or luck or a little bit of both, we were able to pull it off over a relatively short span of time. Now, I can certainly see why entrepreneurs build companies and eventually sell them and start new ones over and over and over again. I'd say the harder path is to disrupt yourself.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. So many lessons, so much value. That was tricky.
The question of fraud. So I know you differentiate on transparency and on minimizing fraud. How did it evolve over time? Was there a fraud problem in the early years, and did it get worse with programmatic? And is it better now? Or is that narrative not correct?
Well, I have to go back to that pivot because I'm glossing somewhat over those early invite media connections that we were able to establish integrating with Turn or MediaMath or DataZoo in the early days. Those are really hard cases to build. Most of those DSPs had no resources for exchange integrations, felt that they were sufficiently supplied with the incumbents at the time, the SSP early incumbents. And when we would walk in to say, hey, how about you integrate Index? We were usually met with, why are you here? We're here to put you guys to bed and go away. Our story, which is as true today as it was back then, was at some point, supply is going to matter an awful lot. And the quality and the barrier to entry for supply is only going to grow. And that's what we stand for. And early days, programmatic had no bar at all. If you look at where the early exchanges emerged, they were effectively auctioning off the impressions that nobody else wanted to buy. It was typically bottom of the barrel. It was typically remnant. It was typically very poor viewability, certainly rife with fraud, spoofing and all kinds of things. But it created the market condition to allow programmatic to emerge. But the metaphor that we used at the time was, you're taking the most powerful, sophisticated form of advertising we have ever conceived of, and then you're asking buyers to dig through the trash to find gems. This does not make any sense at all. Our pitch was, keep all the great things that programmatic represents, and we're just going to give you the gems, you know, the most polarizing industry innovation that certainly helped, and this was in more recent times, was something as novel as ads.txt, you know, the idea of having every publisher declare the seat holder who represents their media. So simple, not a solve for sophisticated IVT or anything like that. However, fundamentally changed, you know, bad practices like spoofing overnight. And, you know, the good exchanges and the good suppliers benefited greatly. And, you know, those that perhaps had questionable quality, you know, had some varied impacts. You know, we've also seen some great vendors, companies like Human or sure. IAS are now pretty much always on. They're either activated pre-bid on the DSP or pre-bid on the exchange. At Index, 100% of our supply hits Human first before it's auctioned. You know, nothing's perfect and the bad actors will always find a way, but this is all about reducing the economic incentive. I think the market is world ahead of where it was a decade ago.
Yeah, I mean, cybersecurity is, in general is an ongoing arms race. So Absolutely. It never stops. But it does seem as though fraud is less than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Like early days programmatic, yeah. You could declare a domain as a seller, as yours. Yeah. You know, you could declare, I'm selling a banner on google.com. And a DSP would take that seriously. I'm not trying to diminish the sophistication of our infrastructure, but that was very early days programmatic. Today, if you tried to do the same thing, you would immediately get a no bid because you're not in that file.
So when header bidding came along in 2016, did that have an impact on Index?
I think we had a lot to do with header bidding coming along and becoming popular. Frustration in the market at the time than we did in the prior era, in that SSPs, early SSPs, didn't feel that different from ad networks from a business model perspective. The SSP fee in the early programmatic era wasn't very transparent. There were typically two fees. One of them would be negotiated between the SSP and the publisher, and one of them was unnegotiated between the SSP and the publisher and bucketed into something called a buy-side fee. And in many cases, that fee could be bigger. And so, you know, our business model was fully transparent, very simple, one fee, 100% of the time, fully auditable. And we would run into this challenge where a situational advantage could inhibit a more efficient business model from being recognized. What do I mean by that? A lot of the early SSPs had well-entrenched positions at the top of what we call the waterfall, which you can look at that as sort of a serialized decision tree that every publisher uses. So, you know, maybe ESPN had its number one SSP and maybe Washington Post had its number one SSP. And maybe we were number two or maybe we were number three. The problem was, as a publisher, it was really hard to know that you were getting a good deal or not if you were comparing somebody at the top position to somebody in the third position, because somebody in the top position had a privileged right of access and priority. Header bidding was really set into motion to completely eliminate this waterfall, to make everything fair and level, and to allow situational advantage to be diminished and value and efficiency to rise, whereby it shouldn't matter if we are called first or third. It shouldn't matter if another one of our competitors is called first and third. We should be judged by the value we drive and the efficiency we drive. At the time, it was called a hack by Google. That was their very polite way of diminishing its potential longevity. And, you know, to some degree, it was a hack. It was inspired by some great early work by some pioneering publishers, but it actually solved an incredibly important business problem, which was the ability to run a level and fair playing field as a publisher to maximize one's yield. And I think it shepherded a bit of a changing of the guards into motion on the SSP side, where some of those early business models were exposed. And some of those players had some difficult conversations with their publishers, but ultimately brought us to the market we're in today, which is much, much harder to game, which is very, very good, I think, for both marketers and also publishers.
So you mentioned great pioneering work by early publishers. What was that?
as Index in the early header days, we our only claim is that we helped popularize header bidding, but we certainly did not invent it. You know, it was well known that go back 5-6 years, companies like Amazon had some early header bidding tech with the A9 bidder. You had Audience Science with Procter & Gamble. It used to be place all your vendors in the ad server and let the ad server make a relatively crude decision. And then it became leverage the header to push inputs into the ad server in real time and empower the publisher with more data than they've ever had. And that's really how we got to the current state today, where super sophisticated yield management is now facilitated by just about every publisher on the planet using some form of header bidding.
I was at Ramp Up this week and Jeff Green was there talking as he every time I've seen him. And talk to him very optimistically about the future and our bright future together. Do you feel in general optimistic for publishers on the open web and the future of the open web right now from where you sit?
I am an eternal optimist. I am no less optimistic about the path in front than I was yesterday. I will say we are living in a very unique time where the open web has guardians that weren't there before, that are in a unique position to set rules of the road. And, you know, typically those rules of the road would be set by government, but now they're set by blog posts. That's new and that's different. I do hope that the decisions that are made on the road ahead are balanced and are not, you know, favoring self-interest too much. Because that's concerning. I do think that the open web has created so much value for humanity, and I would not want to see it walk backwards. I think a lot of the changes that are being made that are consumer first are very positive and will be very positive for the longevity of the ecosystem. I hope that they're made in a balanced way to also ensure that a value exchange can always be struck between content creators and publishers and the end consumer. And so long as that's also possible, I think the future of the open web has never been brighter.
Are you going to miss the cookie?
No, you know what's funny? We started the company before the cookie was used in advertising, and we will
very much
enjoy a future with no cookie involved in our platform. We've lived it out.
You've outlived the cookie.